is Christian Questions.
Theodore Roosevelt once said, "There has never yet been a man in our history who led a life of ease whose name is worth remembering." Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Christian Questions Talk Radio with a Purpose with Jonathan and Rick. We are here to discuss with you, our listeners, thought-provoking and meaningful topics based on the Bible. It's a call-in format. We are very caller-friendly, and we certainly look forward to hearing your point of view. As always, our perspective is this. We believe that there is one God, and through him there is one truth which is found in the Bible. Our purpose is to stir your thinking up along with ours as we continually search for clarity in understanding this one truth.
While we are not here to teach, we are here to seriously provoke your thinking, according to Hebrews 10:24, which is the theme for our program. And let us consider one another to provoke unto love and good works. This provoking is encouraged by Isaiah 1:18. Come now and let us reason together. And this provoking is based on godly principles, family values, honest dialogue, all in a politically free zone. And the only end result we seek to accomplish is to bring praise, honor, and glory to God our Father and Jesus our Lord.
If you'd like to contact us or suggest a topic for a future program and receive a Christian Questions travel mug, here's what you do.
You write us at Christian Questions, P.O. Box 1837, New London, Connecticut 06320, or check us out on the web at www.christianquestions.net. Today is August 16th, 2009. All audio and printed material are copyrighted and are the property of Christian Questions.
So on behalf of Jonathan, my co-host.
Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. And Fred, the man behind the board.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Fred. We want to welcome you to this hour of our program. So, Jonathan, sir, what's new and exciting?
I don't know.
You don't know.
But last week we talked about, is faith healing real?
That was new and exciting. That was a great subject. Went through a lot of aspects of faith healing and the biblical perspective on faith healing and the reasons for faith healing in the New Testament and where we are in the stream of time from obviously from our perspective regarding healing and the laying on of hands and all of those things. Very fascinating. I love going through subjects like that. When you look back and you see things, then you say, okay, well, now how does that work now? Is it different? Is it the same? Why is it different, or why would it be the same? So I thought that was an interesting topic, folks. We hope you enjoyed that as well.
Well, Rick, this morning our question is, what makes a hero? And our theme text is found in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 7. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith.
And Jonathan, we all need heroes, people to look up to, whose example we can follow, whose actions we can emulate, whose courage we can admire, and whose conviction we can meditate upon. People whose circumstances gave no hope, for the odds that were stacked against them were so lopsided that they, by all logic and sense of self-preservation, should have given up or accepted fate or just let it be. But because of a cause that burned a deep conviction within them, they rose up, they fought, they persevered, they challenged, they stayed the course, and they courageously overcame the impossible. Stay with us this morning as we look into the Bible and try to understand the anatomy of a hero. And this is not a science class.
Well, Rick, we do only have one question for consideration this morning, and that question is, what makes a hero?
And obviously, we have an idea about the answer to that question.
Yes, we do.
And we'll share that with you very shortly. So, to get started, we want to talk about what is it? What does it mean to be a hero? And folks, if you have a hero in your life or an example of someone you look at and admire and respect for their heroism, let us know, because that would be an interesting thing for us to hear. It's toll-free 866-985-4255. Once again, toll-free 866-985-4255, and that is live Sunday mornings right now from 6 to 8.
Well, Rick, let's take a look at some definitions of the word hero, and we use the online dictionary. The first is a man of distinguished courage or ability, admired for his brave deeds and noble qualities.
All right. So, distinguished courage or ability. Go ahead.
And next, a person who, in the opinion of others, has heroic qualities or has performed a heroic act and is regarded as a model or ideal. He was a local hero when he saved the drowning child.
All right, and I like the part in that particular definition, is regarded as a model or an ideal. So when you think of someone as a hero, the idea is you look to them as a model for something, some way of acting or some way of being. There's something to model one's life after.
Third definition, the principal male character in a story, play, or film, etc.
Yes, we move in and we see that our hero is doing this, that, or the other thing. And then skip down. Definition number 5, I like this one.
A hero sandwich.
And number 6?
The bread or roll used in making a hero sandwich.
All right. That's not the kind of hero we're focusing on, but I just thought it was kind of interesting that it's in the definitions in the online dictionary of a hero. So, again, folks, we're looking at what makes a hero. What's the anatomy of a hero? And there are a number of things that we think are apply to that. And, Jonathan, we actually touched on this back in January, just very, very briefly. If you remember, we did a two-part series on Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, we were talking about Daniel from the standpoint of a hero, but we didn't go into the what we call the anatomy of a hero at that time. So we're sort of picking that up, 8 months later. So let's start with some examples of heroes, just to get our minds thinking along the right lines.
Well, first, let's start with Mother Teresa. Here was a woman who was born into a wealthy and influential family, but who saw a world that needed equity, a world that had ignored those who were without, and she dedicated her life as a nun to giving to the most unfortunate, the dying, the starving. The following is a quote from the U.S. News and World Report after she died.
All right, and this is the quote. Mother Teresa refused to solicit funds. Asking where the money came from invariably drew the same laconic reply, "The Lord provides." That he does, through a support network that ranges from school children saving their coins to the wealthy solving their consciences. In 1992, for example, she flew to New York to be presented with a $100,000 award by the Knights of Columbus. Now listen to this. At a white tie banquet attended by 1,000 of America's Catholic elites, Mother Teresa was accorded the kind of roaring adulation usually reserved for rock stars or the Pope. Before the feast began, the diminutive nun chastened the throng by describing how it took her 3 hours to pick maggots from the body of an emancipated Calcutta derelict. Then, as was her custom, she left before eating because she felt it was inappropriate to dine ostentatiously. An additional $100,000, equal to the cost of the banquet, was later presented to her. The Lord provides.
Wow.
And isn't that interesting?
It is.
You're given, you're in this environment of being so lauded for your work, and it didn't affect her.
And that was the attitude of her entire life.
Yeah.
Always giving, always humble, always concerned. God-fearing, humankind-serving, a true hero.
And you look at what she did with her life, and it really is remarkable. And see, to me, Jonathan, that's the kind of hero we want to focus on. There's a difference between performing a heroic act. Like in the definition you said, he was a hero because he saved the drowning child.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing to question about that heroic act.
Correct.
But what we want to look at, even more than that, is a heroic lifetime. We want to look at examples that show you over and over, through the passing of time, they're staying with higher standards or stepping out further than most, so that they make some kind of a difference within their environment. And Mother Teresa certainly did that in her life. She was dedicated to the underserved and underprivileged and the less fortunate, and she every day did something to try to help them to have a better life. That's a wonderful, wonderful example.
Another example, Abraham Lincoln. In the most tumultuous time in our nation's history, this man stood tall in his leadership and humility as he followed his vision of freedom and liberty for all of the people of this country. An illustration of this humble leadership is found when he addressed our nation from the battlefield at Gettysburg. Here was an opportunity time to discourse, to labor the points of freedom, to bear down on his fellows for support. The speaker before him spoke for 2 hours. Now it was Abe Lincoln's turn, the most honored president of the United States, and he took less than 10 minutes.
You've got to think about this, because in those days, when politicians spoke, they went on for hours. See, we could, you know, what we'll say to that is, oh, just text me. And, you know, text me the Cliff Notes summation of it, because we couldn't handle that. But that was very typical for an honored politician, for the president to only speak for a few minutes in that context would have been very, very unusual. Just want to read through very quickly the Gettysburg Address. We certainly won't read it the way Lincoln did, but 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war, and that was Gettysburg. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives, that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what was said here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather to be dedicated to the unfinished work which they fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to the cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that the government of the people, by the people and for the people, shall not perish from the earth. And if you analyze those words, there is great, great power in those few words at such an important moment in history.
What a simple, straightforward approach to every man's God-given right to freedom.
And again, it was just such a short speech. And it's interesting, he says, the world will little note nor long remember what was said here. No.
We did remember.
Well, and it's because this is one of the greatest political, quote-unquote, speeches in American history, because it put into perspective in so few words the massive toil and difficulty they were undergoing. This was an awful, bloody civil war, but Lincoln's focus was to keep the nation unified. He was focused on that, and the freedom of slavery came as a result of that unification of the nation.
Another hero, Martin Luther King Jr. In 1963, 100 years later, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, this same cry for freedom was once again echoed throughout this country, this time by a man, a black man, whose background was one of poverty and discrimination. On that hot summer day, he had prepared a speech. As he was delivering his message, he suddenly put aside his notes and began to deliver his true message, the message that burned a vision into his heart. The following is a portion of that message.
And we've actually played parts of this on the program before, and I'm only going to read a small part of this. But this is the part that was relatively impromptu. This was the part that wasn't written down. This is the part that, at the moment, he just had this vision. And I'm going to skip down to the last paragraph there, Jonathan, and start. Says, I have a dream that one day the state of Alabama, whose governor's lips are presently dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, will be transformed into a situation where little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls and walk together as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today that one day every valley shall be exalted and every hill and mountain shall be made low, and the rough places will be plains and the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I shall return to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, pray together, struggle together, go to jail together, stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. Folks, these are examples of heroes in action. What we want to discuss this morning is, how do we find what made them go, and then how can we apply those things to ourselves and, in fact, learn to live in a heroic manner?
This is Jonathan and Rick with Christian Questions. Grab your Bibles. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Christian Questions.
Welcome back to Christian Questions with Jonathan and Rick. We're live Sunday mornings from 6 to 8. Our subject this morning, what makes a hero? To be a part of our program, call 866-985-4255. That's 866-985-4ALL.
And we're talking about heroes. We talked in the first segment. We gave some examples of heroes, historic heroes that we can all look at and say, wow, they did something pretty spectacular with their lives. We were looking at Mother Teresa. We were looking at Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King Jr. Now, let me state at this point, none of them were perfect.
Good point.
And they all had faults.
Sure.
But they dedicated their lives to something greater than themselves. And that's part of being a hero. And it sounds almost corny, you know, when you think of a hero, oh, Superman, dun-da-da-da. But there's something about a regular human being hero that to me is awe-inspiring. And we want to get into that this morning. So, Jonathan, as we begin to take apart and look at the anatomy of a hero, let's suggest to you folks that there are what we'll call the five C's, as in ABC, five C's of heroism. What are they?
The first is conscience, one that is finely tuned.
And we're going to go through, we're going to list these out, then go through them each one at a time and look at how they apply to living a heroic life. What's the second?
Circumstances, such that require heroic acts.
All right.
Third is cause, one that is noble. And the fourth is courage, above that of normal people. And the fifth is conviction, that burns deeply within and dictates one's actions.
So, conscience, circumstances, cause, courage, and conviction. These are things, these are ingredients that go into an individual. And when you have someone who not just does a heroic act, but lives heroically, that's what we're talking about. I think you're going to find these five things in line with whatever their heroism was attached to.
Good point.
So, let's take a look at this. Let's look at our theme text in its context, because what we find in the Bible is God's heroes stand firm and devout through the test of time. And that's why we're looking at a heroic life rather than a... Don't want to minimize heroic acts.
Right.
But that's not the subject, okay? It's a heroic life that we're interested in. Go ahead, Jonathan. Sorry.
Our theme text is found in 2 Timothy 4, and we're going to read 6 through 8. For now I am ready to be offered, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith. Henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord shall give me at that day, and not to me only, but unto all them also that love his appearing.
So the apostle is he's writing his farewell address to Timothy. And he's saying, I'm ready to be offered. The time of my I don't have much longer to live. And he's saying, I fought the good fight. I finished my course. I've kept the faith. And now there's a reward later. But he is saying goodbye. And as he's saying goodbye, he's recounting part of his life. He could have only said this after a life of sacrifice and dedication to a cause that was much bigger than he was. His confidence here, because it sounds like you can look at that and say, well, boy, he's pretty cocky. Look at him. Well, I finished the race. I've kept the faith. But if you look at his life and what made his life work, his confidence was based on the grace of God through Jesus.
You're right.
And we know that because he tells us that in his earlier writings. Let's take a look at 2 Corinthians 12, 7 to 10.
And lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it might depart from me. And he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong.
And again, if you take just a couple of lines out of that that scripture, Jonathan, you can say, well, this guy's pretty strange. I take pleasure in infirmities and in reproaches and in needs and persecutions. What kind of guy is this? And he's saying, the reason I take this pleasure in these things is because I am realizing that my personal weakness is an opportunity for Christ to be stronger in me. That's what he's talking about. He's putting the strength of God through Christ as his main motivation for his entire life. That's what made him such a hero.
Well, Rick, let's go to the phones, and we have Randall from East Lyme, Connecticut. Good morning, Randall. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great.
Okay, we're going to go right to Chronicles because it's a little longer. I have a little more of stuff than usual. Then David said to his son Solomon, "Be firm and steadfast. Go to work without fear or discouragement. For the Lord God, my God, is with you. He will not fail you or abandon you before you have completed all the work you have for the service of the Lord." And Walter Lippmann said, this one is the greatest of all perplexities in theology has been to reconcile the infinite goodness of God with his omnipotence. So how do we go to work for God and go to work in our lives? You know, like Toynbee said, God's love is unlimited, but his power is not. How do we go forward? You know, for example, marching into the gas chambers in Auschwitz with this idea that God, or this knowledge that God is good. And we come back here that God will not fail you or abandon you before you've completed the work for the house of the Lord. And what I would say is that a hero is someone who believes. Remember David going up against Goliath. A hero is someone who believes that the impossible is possible through faith in God, and that God empowers us. And Walter, and you know, and Mother Teresa, you were bringing up Mother Teresa earlier. You know, she went through a dark night of the soul, but she still followed through with her faith in God. And just to close, William James said, "If you want equality, act as if you already had it." And with faith in God, we can get through what is even the most awful of situations.
Good references, points. Thank you so much, Randall.
It's always a pleasure. Love you guys.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Very, very good. And actually, we're going to be touching on the David and Goliath incident in some detail, and I'm glad he brought that up. But the quote that he gave with David giving Solomon advice, saying the Lord will be with you. Do the work. Don't stop. Go do the work. And it was referring to the building of the temple. And saying you've got to follow through. This is something David couldn't do; God would not let him. So it was Solomon's privilege and responsibility. So the idea is that the heroes are moving forward through life, and they've got something bigger than themselves. And I think that's such an important part of this whole picture here.
Well, Rick, let's go back to the phones, and we have Larry from Preston, Connecticut. Good morning, Larry. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. How are you today?
Doing well.
Good. You know, one thing that I think all these three heroes that you mentioned that they had in common was they had a strong faith in God.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they saw an injustice. Mother Teresa saw so much wealth in the world and so much poverty, people starving to death.
Right.
He wanted to do something about it. Abraham Lincoln, a terrible injustice of slavery. God put it on their hearts, I believe, to, you know, work against these injustices. Martin Luther King, he knew he was putting his life on the line.
Yeah.
And yet he did it to correct the terrible injustice that was going on in this country. And, but unfortunately, I think today, I don't know, it frightens me. You know, somebody just mentioned the Holocaust in Germany. Well, Germany was a Christian nation. What happened to their Christianity? What made them think that they were following Jesus Christ with that type of injustice going on? What makes people think in this country with over 90 million Christians, a Judeo-Christian nation, if we can keep electing people that don't respect the right to life, they don't respect the sanctity of life. Jesus said, what you do to the least, my brethren, you do to me. Are we serving Jesus Christ when we keep putting people in office that don't believe in the sanctity of life? I mean, this country is schizophrenic. Everyone's upset that someone who harmed an animal, which is deplorable, is going to be playing for the NFL again. But yet there's 4,000 abortions a day and you don't hear anything about it.
Right, right.
There's a soul sickness in this country, and we need a real conversion. We need to get back to following Jesus Christ, and we have to do that. We have to do it soon.
Well, thank you, Larry. Appreciate your conviction.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, when I hear Larry and him talking about those issues, you know, Larry in along those lines is a hero in his own right.
You got it.
He's not afraid to speak out and say what's on his mind, and he is looking to protect those who don't have a voice. And that's honorable. That is wonderful, and that's honorable. Keep up that zeal of yours, Larry. We appreciate it very much. But he's right. You get into a situation where you're looking at life, you're looking at circumstances, and it just doesn't seem to work, doesn't seem to fit. What's wrong with this picture? We don't have heroes that seem to have all of these things anymore. What happened? Let's get into all of what things. Remember those five C's? We haven't even started on them. We're near the second end of the second segment here. Let's get going.
Well, the first is conscience, one that is finely tuned.
All right, so let's look up conscience again in the dictionary just to get a sense of it, and then let's look it up from a scriptural sense.
The sense or consciousness of moral goodness or blameworthiness of one's own conduct, intentions, or character, together with a feeling of obligation to do right or to be good.
All right. I like that. The consciousness of the moral goodness or blameworthiness of one's conduct, intentions, or character. The second definition, faculty, power, or principle enjoining good acts, the part of the superego in psychoanalysis that transmits commands and admonitions to the ego. Now, I don't know about the psychoanalysis and ego and superego part. All I know is the idea of conscience being that inner voice that's supposed to guide us. But the real question is always, great, you have that inner voice, but what's guiding it? That's what you need to always ask when you're looking at conscience. What does the word mean in the New Testament?
In the Strong's Concordance, it's number 4893, it means co-perception or moral consciousness.
And I like that sense, that co-perception. We all, like it or not, believe it or not, being willing to admit it or not, we all have conversations with ourselves.
You do.
All right. I deserve that one. But you have that sense where you want to do something, and something inside of you is telling you that's not such a good idea. And then you tell that something, oh, you don't really, and you rationalize and you go through that. So there's a co-perception. It's the bringing together of those two voices within ourselves to execute whatever action those two voices deem appropriate or acceptable. Sometimes we can water down the higher voice with the lower voice, and the higher voice gets drowned out, and then we do something that's not so good, so to speak. The Bible, interestingly enough, says a lot about conscience. So let's just look at a couple of scriptures, at least to get us started along these lines.
Let's start, Rick, with Acts 24:10-16. Then Paul, after the governor had nodded to him to speak, answered, "Inasmuch as I know that you have been for many years a judge of this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself, because you may ascertain that it is no more than 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem to worship, and they neither found me in the temple disputing with anyone, nor inciting the crowd, either in the synagogues or in the city, nor can they prove the things of which they now accuse me. But this I confess to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, so I worship the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets, and I have hope in God, which they themselves also accept, that there will be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. This being so, I myself always strive to have a conscience without offense toward God and men."
That last line sums it up perfectly, is what we're talking about. Okay, great. Let your conscience be your guide. but what guides your conscience? And the Apostle Paul here, in his defense, he's being accused of stirring up the crowd and insurrection, essentially. He's saying, I'm not inciting the crowd. He says, I myself always strive. Now, that's an interesting way to put it. He's not saying, look, he's saying it's not perfect here.
But he works at it.
Right. I always strive to have a conscience without offense toward God and men. So to strive to have a conscience that's without offense toward God is absolutely the best way to go in terms of having our conscience rule our lives. If it's without offense toward God, then it's being guided and directed by something much higher with much more integrity than we have, and our decisions can be much more clear as a result.
This is Jonathan and Rick with Christian Questions. What makes a hero? Stay with us.
You're listening to Christian Questions.
Welcome back to Christian Questions with Jonathan and Rick. We're live Sunday mornings from 6 to 8. Our subject this morning, what makes a hero? To be a part of our program, call 866-985-4255. That's 866-985-4ALL. Our website, christianquestions.net.
Thank you so much. And we are talking about heroism. We're talking about what we call the five C's of heroism. We're on the first one, conscience, then comes circumstances, cause, courage, and then conviction. And Jonathan, just before we go move forward, because obviously we have to get through four more of these and we're almost to the end of the first hour, we're not going to read a lot more scriptures in terms of conscience, but I want to read some quotes. And when you think of heroes who had a really good conscience, I think Mahatma Gandhi was one of those individuals who he was so focused on the objective that everything he did seemed to be in line with his greater cause. And that means his mind was tuned very, very, very precisely. I want to read three quotes from him. One, happiness is when what you think, what you say, and what you do are in harmony.
That's good.
That puts conscience right where it belongs. Happiness is when what you think, what you say, and what you do are in harmony. You can only have that happiness if you're following a finely tuned conscience. He also said, man is but the product of his thoughts. What he thinks, he becomes. Again, he gives you a sense of conscience. And then in terms of putting it in action, one more quote from him, an ounce of practice is worth more than tons of preaching. So it's great to
Very
think
good.
It. Great to think it. But what do you do about it? I think that's the key. What do you do about it? Folks, what are you going to do about it? We're talking about heroism and looking at examples of heroes, perhaps some heroes in your life. Let us know what you think at 866-985-4255. That's toll free, 866-985-4ALL. We're live Sunday mornings from 6 to 8. So, Jonathan, conscience lays the groundwork. Built upon conscience, if your conscience is tuned, rightly tuned as we're talking about, then when circumstances arise, there is a sense of direction. And so that's why circumstances follows conscience in this order here. Circumstances such that require heroic acts. Circumstances are those things which surround you, not necessarily of your own making, but they're there for you to deal with nevertheless. And I think this is important. I think circumstances will always define and reveal your cause, which is the third point. That is your true cause. And let's take a look at some scriptures on this to get a sense of how circumstances end up shaping us in a lot of different ways.
All right, Rick, why don't we turn to Daniel 1, verses 5 through 7. The king assigned them a daily portion of the royal rations of food and wine. They were to be educated for 3 years so that at the end of that time they could be stationed in the king's court. Among them were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, from the tribe of Judah. The palace master gave them other names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego.
All right, so we're going to spend a little bit of time in Daniel here looking at their being brought into the king's court. They're captives. Okay, you're taken prisoner. Let's get this straight. You're taken prisoner, and you're brought to this nation. It's about a 30-day journey from where they were to Babylon. This doesn't look, but the way they're being treated doesn't look like captivity at all. They've got royal rations of food and wine and a free education. What this really was a subtle indoctrination of idolatry for the purpose of creating loyal subjects to the idolatrous king himself.
Yes.
That's why they were being treated so well. They were taken because these were the best and the brightest.
That's right.
They're being taken to be put to use for Babylon's benefit. So it's a removal of your identity. They change their name. It's a removal of your heritage. Because they take you away from it and they replace it.
They're replacing it, yeah.
Right, and they're replacing it with a new name, new language, new belief system, and a new life. The circumstances presented here seem to be not only completely contrary to Daniel's heritage, but they're absolutely non-negotiable. You're a prisoner, and they're just kids.
Yeah.
They're probably teenagers at this point. Here is where you have circumstances rising up to make it very, very difficult to be able to focus on making sure your conscience is right.
Well, Rick, we have another call. Let's go to Julius from Groton, Connecticut. Good morning, Julius. Welcome to Christian Questions.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Gentlemen, my goodness, in the past I could get in so quickly into your program. Now I have to, pretty soon I'll have to submit a request in writing to them, which is good. It's good. What makes a hero? Great topic. The characters you mentioned, the wonderful people you mentioned, Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King, and so forth, Abraham Lincoln. Mahatma Gandhi came to mind, as you already did.
Mm-hmm.
To me, he was a great human being. Here's a definition that appeals to me along your line of thinking. I think it fits in pretty well. A definition of a servant. One of the definitions for a servant is one that exerts self for the benefit of others. I think you find that as a common thread, a common theme in the lives of any true heroes. Look at our day. There's another observation here, how so many of these, I would call them temporary heroes. They, until we find that they have exploited others, until it is revealed that they have indulged in self-gratification and caused scandals, those are temporary heroes, you know. So there is no consistency. A hero demonstrates, exhibits, practices, lives consistency. And of course, I think I don't think I have to tell you this. The greatest hero was the Lord Jesus, I believe. One final reference to Hebrews 11. Remember there where the heroes of faith are mentioned?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The ancient prophets. Here is my, I think it's an interesting closing comment. That is, near the end of the chapter, for their deeds, their heroics, the ancient prophets, the statement is made, the conclusion is made in that chapter of Hebrews 11 that, quote, of whom the world was not worthy. Thanks for sharing that great topic. God bless.
Thank you, Julius. Appreciate your input.
Have a nice day. Bye-bye.
Julius brought up actually a number of good things. I just want to comment on two. That last comment he made about those listed in Hebrews 11,
mm-hmm.
of whom the world was not worthy, because they were dedicated to something so much bigger than themselves.
That's for sure.
I think that's interesting. The other thing I really appreciated about his comments were he likened a hero to a servant.
Mm.
And that's when you get a hero who really, really fits that definition, you look at it, and that's what we admire so much about them, their ability to serve others by whatever it is they're dedicated to.
Sure. And he also brought out a sixth C, consistency.
Yeah, yeah. And that really sort of bring some of these other things right together, because you need to be consistent to live a heroic life. Not perfect, except for Jesus. Not perfect, because we can't be, but consistent. You make a mistake, you go back to what you were originally guided by. And we're looking at, actually, and we won't be doing a lot with Daniel today because we did a number of months ago, but we're going to be looking at Daniel beginning his role of being that consistent hero. We read Daniel 1, 5 through 7, putting them in context, being taken captive as young men. What does Daniel 1, 8 say?
But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the royal rations of food and wine, so he asked the palace master to allow him not to defile himself.
So he had resolved. There's the first key. He has an awful lot. That's got an awful lot to do with conscience.
Oh, yeah.
He resolved that he's only a kid and he's captive.
A teenager.
And yet he stands up and says, this is not right for me. I can't do this. So we won't take the time to read it, but Daniel chapter 1, verses 9 to 14, he talks to the individual in charge of them and says, here, let's try this.
Yeah, give me some vegetables and water and see how healthy I can become just on that.
So he and his three companions go on that diet versus the diet from the king's table.
Right.
Now, the diet from the king's table was meant to butter you up.
Yep.
It was meant to make you feel pretty special. You're getting the same kind of food the king gets.
Wow, aren't you special?
Yes, you are. And so for 10 days they do this, and we find that after the 10 days, we'll get to the after in a moment. Verses 12, just read 12 and 13 here, Jonathan, in Daniel chapter 1, verses 9 to 14 section.
Please test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink, and you can then compare our appearance with the appearance of the young men who eat the royal rations, and deal with your servants according to what you observe.
So he puts it out and says, just give us a chance. Do it for 10 days, then you do what you will with it. So it's an interesting thing. Again, this is a young man.
What wisdom,
yeah,
he used.
For such a young man. So he's got this remarkable wisdom and confidence in God's care, and he offers the simple test. So let's read Daniel 1, 15 to 17.
At the end of 10 days, it was observed that they appeared better and fatter than all the young men who had eaten the royal rations. So the guard continued to withdraw the royal rations and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and skill in every aspect of literature and wisdom. Daniel also had insight into all visions and dreams.
So he kind of proved his point, didn't he?
And God blessed them for their conviction.
And that's the point. They had a conscience that was toward God. Circumstances arose where that conscience was tested, and they were able to put themselves in the right position to do the right things. That's one of the key things about a hero over time, is that ability to do those things. Let's look at Hebrews 11, 24 to 26.
By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to share ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, accounting the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked into the recompense of reward.
So again, and this is going back to the chapter that Julius mentioned earlier. You want to read a chapter that lists out different heroes, go to Hebrews chapter 11. And one of those heroes was Moses.
Yes.
And again, if you look at the life of Moses, what you will see is someone who, through his life, was given experiences so that he could build a conscience toward God. See, the conscience, I think, is the first step. If you want to live a heroic kind of life, your conscience must be rightly tuned. And incidentally, you really can't tune your conscience unless you're humble.
Oh, good point.
So,
you're right.
So the introduction to heroism is humility.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
The first step of heroism, I think, is tuning your conscience. And once that conscience becomes clearly tuned, then when circumstances arise, and guess what? In everybody's life, we have circumstances. And guess what? Most of them aren't pleasant all the time. So your conscience now is in a position to show you where to go and what to do. That brings us to the third step, which we'll cover in the second hour, and that is cause. What is the cause that your conscience is dedicating you to? How are you handling that under pressure? For Jonathan and Rick, this is Christian Questions. We'll be back after the news and all of that. But until then, stay with us. The question, what makes a hero? We'll be back soon. Think about it.
Christian Questions.
Albert Schweitzer said, "I don't know what your destiny will be, but one thing I know, the only ones among you who will really be happy are those who will have sought and found how to serve." Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to Christian Questions Talk Radio with your breakfast with Jonathan and Rick. We're here to discuss with you, our listeners, thought-provoking and meaningful topics based on the Bible. It is a call-in format, and we are. The results are in, and we are caller-friendly. We certainly look forward to hearing your point of view. Jonathan, what are we talking about?
Well, Rick, our question this morning is, what makes a hero? And our theme text is found in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 7. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith.
What makes a hero? What a great subject for a Sunday morning to get you up and inspired and ready to face the day. But before we get back to the subject, Jonathan, you're pointing to the notebook that says, take care of business first.
That's right. We need to let our listeners know that our website is christianquestions.net. And if you're listening live on the website, remember there is a short delay. There are many archive programs to listen to. And if you have any questions or comments, the best way to get in touch is christianquestions.net.
Thank you so much. Our discussion this morning is about being heroic. In the first hour, we gave some examples of heroes in our world that we are all somewhat familiar with. We talked about Mother Teresa for a few minutes. We talked about Abraham Lincoln for a few minutes and Martin Luther King Jr. As three examples of heroic lives. What we want to focus on this morning is heroic lives rather than heroic acts. There's nothing wrong. That's, heroic acts are good. Keep them up.
Oh, yeah.
But we want to look at what makes someone live a heroic life. And we came up with what we call the five C's of heroism. Let's just review them quickly.
The first is conscience, one that is finely tuned. The second, circumstances, such that require heroic acts. The third is cause, one that is noble. The fourth is courage, above that of normal people. And the fifth is conviction, that burns deeply within and dictates one's actions.
So in the first hour, we talked about conscience and circumstances. And we were talking about having, first of all, the basis for all of this is a humble spirit, a humble attitude toward life. But we were talking about how conscience is really the beginning of all of this. You have to have your conscience guided and tuned to something bigger than you are. Once that conscience is tuned, once you come into circumstances, point number two, it's so much easier to figure out what's going on. And the thing about circumstances is they bring reality to the surface, so to speak.
Yeah, you're right.
And if we are really, truly, for instance, if we are paying lip service to something,
it'll show.
Yeah, it'll show, because when you are tested, lip service doesn't hold any, it doesn't have any strength. But if it's your heart that's behind it, even if you falter in the process, something happens and you begin to rise up. There's a phrase out there somewhere that says, and I'm gonna alter it a little bit. I think it says, "Speak your mind." I'm gonna insert the word truth instead of mind. Speak the truth, even if your voice shakes.
Mm.
And I think that's such an important part of this whole thing. So we've looked at conscience and circumstances. And folks, if you have a thought, give us a call. Perhaps you have the example of a heroic individual in your life or someone that you'd like us to draw some attention to, or your comments on these five C's. And remember, your comments can mean an awful lot to the people, other people listening, and it can help us as well. 866-985-4255, toll free, 866-985-4ALL. We're live Sunday mornings from 6 to 8.
Well, this brings us, Rick, to the third C, and that is cause, one that is noble.
And there are lots of noble causes in the world. Let's list a few.
How about education?
Or elimination of poverty.
How about science?
How about preservation? I'm sorry. When Jonathan first read that elimination of poverty, he says, Rick, what does this mean, an elimination of property? I'm sorry. I had to laugh.
Well, thank you for bringing that out.
Anytime. Anyway, science. How about the preservation of the earth is a good cause?
How about equality?
Or medicine?
The gospel.
Salvation for the world. There's lots.
All good.
They're all good causes. And the point of heroism is to have a cause that's noble, that and a heroic cause generally ends up being somewhat selfless.
Mm.
You end up being a servant to the cause rather than serving yourself. And when you've got a good cause, boy, things can change if it's something that's noble. Let's look at the cause of the gospel for both Jews and Gentiles as being one of those great, great, and I think the greatest of all noble causes.
Let's read Romans 15:5-14. Now may the God of patience and comfort grant you to be like-minded toward one another, according to Christ Jesus, that you may with one mind and one mouth glorify the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore receive one another, just as Christ also received us to the glory of God. Now I say that Jesus Christ has become a servant to the circumcision for the truth of God, to confirm the promises made to the fathers, and that the Gentiles might glorify God for his mercy, as it is written, For this reason I will confess to you among the Gentiles and sing to your name. And again he says, Rejoice, O Gentiles, with his people. And again, Praise the Lord, all ye Gentiles, laud him, all you people. And again, Isaiah says, There shall be a root of Jesse, and he will rise to reign over the Gentiles. In him the Gentiles shall hope. Now may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, that you may abound in hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. Now I myself am confident concerning you, my brethren, that you also are full of goodness, filled with all knowledge, able also to admonish one another.
So the apostle here is talking about this great cause of the gospel. And he's saying it's such a great cause because it doesn't affect just one people, but all peoples. And it's interesting how he quotes all of these Old Testament prophecies saying, oh, the Gentiles are going to honor God. The Gentiles are going to worship God. They're going to follow after the God of Abraham. So he's saying this is a worthy cause. This is an earth-changing environment we're dedicated to. It's going to change the world.
A transition is taking place before our eyes.
Right. And he is taken by this cause to such a point that nothing else really seems to matter. And I think that's where you really understand when someone has a cause, when it is so consuming that other things just become trivial almost in relation to their overall life. Folks, if you have a thought, it's 866-985-4255, toll free, 866-985-4-ALL. The cause of Christ is worth giving your life for. And that's what the apostle was alluding to in Romans. Now let's look at how he put it down on paper. On parchment, Philippians 1:15-21.
Some indeed preach Christ even from envy and strife, and some also from goodwill. The former preach Christ from selfish ambition, not sincerity, supposing to add affliction to my chains, but the latter out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is preached. And in this I rejoice. Yes, I will rejoice, for I know that this will turn out for my deliverance through your prayer and supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, according to my earnest expectation and hope that in nothing I shall be ashamed, but with all boldness, as always, so now also Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain.
And when you look at these verses and you really think about what the apostle is saying, he's saying that, okay, Here's the situation we're in. There are those who preach Christ just to cause me trouble. I'm in prison already. They're trying to make it even more difficult for me, and they're doing it for their own gain. And he's saying, what am I going to think about that? And his answer is, I'm rejoicing. And how can you be rejoicing? He says, because Christ is being preached. And it doesn't. His attitude is, the gospel message is going forward. Even if some have a bad motivation, the message is more powerful than those as messengers.
Good point.
And he's saying that I will be delivered. And so you're saying, oh, okay. So he's saying he's looking for his way out. Well, think about how he talks about his deliverance. He says, first of all, according to my earnest expectation and hope, that in nothing I shall be ashamed. So whatever it is, he says, my goal is to never be ashamed of who I am and what I stand for. And then he talks about his deliverance. He says, so that also Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. So you see, he's looking for deliverance, whether it's through continuing to live or death. He's saying, if it costs me my very life, that's my deliverance. And that last line, read that last line again.
For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain.
That's a man who has a cause that is so thoroughly entrenched in him that he cannot be swayed from it. That is a hero. That's a noble cause. To me, that is a hero. When you've got that cause so firm that the boundaries, that the definition between your life and your death really are not material. What matters is that the cause move forward. Folks, if you have a thought, 866-985-4255, toll free, 866-985-4. All, we're live Sunday mornings from 6 to 8.
Well, Rick, that brings us to the fourth C, which is courage, above that of normal people.
I have to admit, whenever I hear that word courage, I think of the Cowardly Lion.
Absolutely.
Courage. And I just think of that. And his desire to have courage, but he just was afraid. He's supposed to be courageous. He's a lion. Anyway, here, let's talk about looking at an example of great courage. Courage that many would look at and label foolishness.
You're right.
And you're right. But when we get to the end of the story, you find out that it's not only courage, it's courage that's based on something. And you know what it is? And this is the story of David and Goliath. And we're gonna paraphrase some of it to try to shrink it down, because otherwise it'll take too long. But the story of David when he goes to face Goliath, think about it. What was his conscience based on?
Honoring God, believing in God.
And he had had circumstances before this where his life was put on the line.
Absolutely. He was a shepherd, and he fought off lions and bears doing his job.
And when he came to the battlefield, which we'll read about in a few moments, he saw the circumstances, and his cause welled up within him.
Oh, it did.
How can you allow God's name to be made mud like this? And that's what gave him the courage to go out. So you see, all of these pieces work together to live a heroic life. So, Jonathan, let's get started with this. We'll read part of this and then before our break.
Now the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle and were gathered, and Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they encamped in the valley of Elam and drew up in the battle array against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on the mountains on the other side, with a valley between them. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath, from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span.
Okay, 6 cubits and a span. Let's translate that. That means he's probably about 9 feet tall.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah. Now, let's talk about intimidation just for a second. This is a big man.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so 9 feet tall. Go ahead.
He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze.
Okay, hold on there for a second. The weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. That would translate to about 220 pounds.
His coat.
His coat of mail. So his armor weighed 220 pounds. I'm happy to admit that's a lot more than I weigh.
And he had bronze armor on his legs and bronze javelin between his shoulders. Now, the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam.
Okay, a weaver's beam. How thick is a weaver's beam? It's about 3 inches thick. So you think about trying to hold a spear in your hand. That's huge.
It is.
That's heavy.
and his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels.
Okay, which means 25 pounds.
Just the head of the spear.
Right.
And a shield bearer went before him. Then he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, "Why have you come up to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And you, the servants of Saul, choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistines said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that may fight together."
The gauntlet was laid down, and this was not a guy that anybody in their right mind wants to go up against in one-on-one battle.
This is Jonathan and Rick with Christian Questions. Grab your Bibles. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Christian Questions.
Welcome back to Christian Questions with Jonathan and Rick. We're live Sunday mornings from 6 to 8. Our subject this morning, what makes a hero? To be a part of our program, call toll-free 866-985-4255. That's 866-985-4-ALL.
Jonathan, we are beginning to go through the account of David and Goliath, and so far we've seen Goliath throw down the gauntlet, so to speak, and this big, huge, massive, powerful man says, "Okay, rather than the two armies fight, just give me somebody to fight me." Okay, you're the biggest and the best, okay? Give me somebody to fight me, and the winner, it's winner take all. So that's where we are so far.
Well, Rick, why don't we go to the phones? We have Max from Waterford, Connecticut. Welcome to the program, Max.
Thank you, gentlemen. How are you today?
Doing
great.
Well.
I just wanted to give a quick definition of courage. Or I use this with my boys all the time, and I use bravery, but I think that the two are interchangeable.
Mm-hmm.
I say being brave doesn't mean that you're not afraid.
Good.
It means that you are afraid, and you do it anyway.
Very good.
Excellent.
That's it. All right, thanks, guys. You guys are awesome.
Thanks, Max.
Great definition, because, see, that's part of the process is the people who are heroic, it doesn't mean that they're above the same emotions that the rest of us have. They just feel the fear, and they just move forward anyway. Somehow or other, they move through it and turn that fear into an asset rather than a liability. So that's a great definition.
Absolutely.
And I like the idea of bravery and courage being interchangeable. So, if your boys are listening, good advice to them. And boys, keep it up. Be brave. Be courageous. Have a cause. When those circumstances arise, make sure your conscience is rightly tuned so you can be heroic in the things that you do. Jonathan, let's get back to the account of David. And we're going to have to skip through a lot of verses here to get through it. We are actually in 1 Samuel chapter 17. Might be hard to follow along, though, because we're skipping some verses to condense it. We're going to start with 11 now.
When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now David was the son of Jesse. The three oldest sons of Jesse had gone to follow Saul to the battle. And the Philistine drew near and presented himself for 40 days, morning and evening.
All right. So
40 days. Whoa.
Well, think about it. Who in their right mind is going to go fight that guy one-on-one? And he's got Israel afraid. And every day, in the morning and in the evening, he comes out and says, "Isn't there anybody in your entire army who's willing to fight me?" And he's mocking the God of Israel, and he's mocking the soldiers of Israel. And he does this every single day. David arrives. David's not a soldier. David's a shepherd. Okay?
That's right.
Again, probably a teenager at this point. So let's jump down to verse 26 to 29.
Then David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, "Who was this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard what he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was aroused against David, and he said, "Why did you come down here, and with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and your insolence of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle." And David said, "What have I done now? Is there not a cause?"
Now, he's looking at the situation saying, wait a minute, look at this. Now, David is young. He's the youngest of the brothers. And yet he sees what others don't. He, and this is, really goes along with Max's call and his comment, he sees there's something bigger than this, and he's seeing the fear, but he's also seeing through the fear.
You're right.
He's seeing that something must be done. Just let's jump down to verse 32 and then go down through whenever.
Then David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against the Philistine to fight with him, for you are a youth, and he a man of war from his youth."
Now think about that. What a great statement. Look, your kid, he's been fighting since he was a kid, and he's grown up a little bit, like 9 feet tall's worth of growing up. So how can you possibly dream about facing this individual?
But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep, and when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defiled the armies of the living God." Moreover, David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you."
This is the most faithful response that has been heard to this challenge, this battle challenge. David's attitude is, this man is defying the armies of the living God, first of all, and that just shouldn't be. And he said, "I have been given strength by God. He delivered me from the paw of the lion, from the paw of the bear. He will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." So he is giving God the credit. He's not saying, "Look, I may be young, but boy, do I have dexterity. Boy, can I, boy, can I fight. Boy, can I."
I can throw those rocks well.
No. He's saying very simply, very clearly, God has delivered me. This is something we should not tolerate. God will deliver me here too. There is a willingness to see through the fear of the moment.
Bravery.
That the entire army was feeling so they could move forward. So, if your conscience is tuned rightly and the circumstances call for dramatic action, then your cause rises to the top. David's cause was God will deliver him. He is a servant of God. And the cause took over, even though the odds were impossible. Let's go to the third phase of this. That was the reaction phase. Now let's go to the response phase.
So Saul clothed David with his armor, and he put on a bronze helmet on his head, and he also clothed him with a coat of mail. David fastened his sword to his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. And David said to Saul, "I cannot walk with these, for I have not tested them."
Now remember, Saul was a man who stood head and shoulders above the rest of Israel.
Right.
He was a big man. David was still a kid. He couldn't wear his armor. It was too big.
So David took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand, and he chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook, and put them in a shepherd's bag, in a pouch which he had, and a sling was in his hand. And he drew near to the Philistine. So the Philistine came and began drawing near to David, and the man who bore the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was only a youth, ruddy and good-looking. So the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field."
So after 40 days, let's get the picture. 40 days of taunting. Now Israel sends forth their warrior. Number one, he's not wearing any armor. And number two, he's a kid.
He has a staff and a sling.
That's it. And this giant is made all the more angry. He's, "I'm going to rip you to pieces. I'm going to feed your flesh to the birds. How can you even treat me like this? I'm expecting a warrior. I'm expecting to have to fight somebody, not to step on somebody." I mean, that's his attitude. So the giant only fed the tiny shepherd's resolve to fulfill his cause with courage, because he becomes even more insulting. Goliath becomes more insulting. And now listen to this. Here's the fourth phase. This is the proclamation. This is where the courage really, really comes into place, because he has got a cause.
Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defiled. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands."
This little pipsqueak of a person telling this great, mighty,
9 foot tall,
unbeatable warrior that you come to me with a sword and a spear, and I'm coming to you in the name of the Lord of hosts. And so David is saying to him, it's really not a fair battle. I'm just telling you that. That's what he's saying. He says, this is not a fair battle. He says, you come to me with all this stuff. I have got God on my side. God will deliver me through this and deliver your army into our hands. This is so out of the ordinary. There's such great courage here. And so now we have courage in action. Let's finish up this account.
So it was when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, that David hurried and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. Then David put his hand in his bag, took out one stone, and he slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead, so that the stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword and drew it out of its sheath, and killed him, and cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled.
So they didn't live up to their bargain, did they?
No, of serving the other army.
Because by making the bargain, now, think about that. There's lip service there, isn't there?
Oh, yeah.
It's just lip service. You've got the biggest and the greatest, so you're not worried about the consequences. And yet, the God of heaven delivers David in this through great courage. Now, I can imagine that David must have felt fear.
Oh, big time.
But he acted through the fear, and he brought down this giant and won this battle. So courage is an absolutely necessary part of being a hero. You can't be a hero without courage. So you have your conscience, you have your circumstances, you have your cause, and that brings out your courage.
And Rick, that brings us to number five, the fifth C. That's conviction, that burns deeply within and dictates one's actions.
And folks, if you have a thought on heroism or a hero in your life or an example that you'd like to share with us, we'd love to hear from you. The number is toll-free 866-985-4255. Once again, toll-free 866-985-4ALL. We are live Sunday morning, 6 to 8.
Some definitions of conviction: the act or process of convicting of a crime, especially in a court of law. The act of convincing a person of error or of compelling the admission of a truth. The state of being convinced of error or compelled to admit the truth.
And number three?
A strong persuasion or belief. The state of being convinced.
And I think that's really when we look at conviction in this context, that's what we're looking at, that third definition, mm-hmm. A strong persuasion or belief. And Jonathan, it's my thought on this, particularly that those first four things that we talked about, conscience and
circumstances
and cause and courage, mm-hmm. are repeatable through life.
Yes.
When you continually repeat them through life, you are now living a convicted life.
Good point.
So conviction ties them all together. You can have those four things and be heroic, but you become a hero when you continually live those four things, because now your life is convicted. It is so firmly set in its way that it can't be deterred, similar to David against Goliath. Now, it doesn't mean that David was without sin.
You're right.
And we know that comes into his life later on. Similar to Paul, the Apostle Paul, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. That is conviction. That is, you are so firmly set that you can't be turned away from your goal and your objective. And so conviction being the fifth, I think, ties it all together as a way of life rather than just an action in life. Heroic actions happen all the time. Heroes don't. I think that's the difference. That's what conviction says to us. It helps us to rise above the whole matter. And Jonathan, before we get into the scriptures on that, let's go into a break. Folks, we're talking about heroic actions that lead to a heroic life. How do you focus on becoming heroic, not just in a day or two, but over a long lifetime?
This is Jonathan and Rick with Christian Questions. We'll be back right after this break.
You're listening to Christian Questions.
Welcome back to Christian Questions with Jonathan and Rick. We're live Sunday mornings from 6 to 8. Our subject this morning is what makes a hero. To be a part of our program, call toll-free 866-985-4255. That's 866-985-4ALL.
Jonathan, we're talking about the anatomy of a hero. And like we said in the first hour, it's not a science class. But we're looking at what makes somebody heroic, not just once in their life, but for a lifetime. So we're going through these 5 points of heroism: conscience, circumstance, cause, courage. And now we're on to the fifth one, conviction. And conviction ties them all together. Let's look at an example from Daniel chapter 3 that we're going to paraphrase it in the interest of time here, but shows us conviction over a lifetime. This is, remember we talked about Daniel a little bit earlier?
Yes.
And you had Daniel and his three friends. Mm-hmm. They were very young.
Yes.
Fast forward about 20 years or so.
King Nebuchadnezzar made a golden statue or a golden image, as we recall, and all the officials of the province were assembled to come together, and basically they were commanded to worship this image. And when the music started, and it was a big fanfare,
yep,
everyone was to bow and worship this image.
So you set up the... Now, Nebuchadnezzar is a great king.
Oh, yeah.
And he's got the biggest kingdom of the earth at this point in time.
That's right.
And he's got this image. Everybody's supposed to bow down to it. Now, these three men, they were no longer boys, but now they're men, are commanded to bow down. So you have the trumpets being blown and all of the music and da-da-da-da-da-da.
And they don't bow down and worship the image.
All right. So, and then they get tattled on.
Oh, yes, they do.
O king, live forever. These guys, these Jews that we brought into the land many years ago that wouldn't bow down when all the music sounded.
And remember, he called them Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Right. Those are their Babylonian names.
Right.
And actually, read verse 12 and
sure.
Verse 12.
There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These pay no heed to you, O king. They do not serve your gods, and they do not worship the golden statue that you have set up.
So now, remember what the king said. If you didn't worship this statue,
you'd be thrown into the fiery furnace, would be the penalty.
Right. This furnace of blazing fire. Not a good situation. Not a good end result. And again, so you see this happening. And the reason this fits so well is because this is so many years after these young men who were teenagers in the earlier account we dealt with earlier in the program. This is many, many, many years later. And what it's showing us is they still held to their convictions.
They did.
So their belief wasn't merely lip service.
No.
It was heart service.
It was their life.
Yes, absolutely was. Because years and years later, it would have been so easy to just bow down so you don't show up in the crowd. Look, people are going to see you.
Yeah.
Because if everybody's standing all together, you got this mass of people, and then everybody all, when they hear the music, they all get down on their hand and prostrate themselves, and you're still standing, people are going to notice, hey, who are those guys? Look, there's three of them. Look, right? Oh, yeah, those guys.
What are they doing?
Right. Because they didn't listen to the king. And kings in those days were not, let's just say they weren't known for their patience. They weren't known for their understanding.
Yeah.
So let's read now. Now, let's actually read the next section, Daniel 3, verses 13 to 15.
Then Nebuchadnezzar in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought in. So they brought those men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods and you do not worship the golden statue that I have set up?"
So he brings them in and he questions them. Now, this is interesting because a king would normally say, burn them.
Yep.
And especially Nebuchadnezzar, he was that way.
But he, remember, early on, he saw them as better than all the other, you know, people around him.
And they were in positions of great authority in his kingdom.
Yes.
So he knew them.
He respected them.
Right. And now, in verse 15, let's look at what the king does.
Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the drum, and the entire musical ensemble, to fall down and worship that statue that I have made, well and good.
See? So he's saying, I'll give you another chance.
But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be thrown into a furnace of blazing fire. And who is the God that will deliver you out of my hands?
Now, there's a lot of things going on in that verse, aren't there?
Big time.
So he gives them a chance, which is very unusual.
Yes.
And says, okay.
Come on, guys.
Yeah. Help me here. Help me. I'm going out on a limb for you. You got to obey, otherwise you're going to get thrown into the fire. And who is the God that can deliver you out of that? Now, if Nebuchadnezzar would have not been so taken by himself, he would have remembered how the God of these young men had delivered him previously. But he didn't.
Right.
He just didn't. And folks, if you have a thought, 866-985-4255, toll free, 866-985-4-ALL. We'd love to hear from you on what makes a hero.
Well, Rick, let's continue in Daniel 3:16-18. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered the king, O King Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to present a defense to you in this matter.
Now, think about that for a second. He's giving them a second chance, and he's willing to set the whole thing up again for them. And their response is, save your time, save your effort. We don't even have a need to present a defense here. There is such a conviction in those words alone.
Mm.
In those words, no need. It shows you how they have been developed in their heroism throughout their lives. It didn't get put aside in this foreign land. It was developed.
And listen to these words, Rick. If our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire and out of your hand, O king, let him deliver us. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods and we will not worship the golden statue that you have set up.
They were willing to put their very lives on the line. And the way they phrased that, if our God delivers us.
His choice.
That's right. He can do that. But if he doesn't, be it known to you. And again, this is almost a role reversal. Who's putting out the words of great authority here? Is it the king?
No.
No, it's not. It's not. Be it known to you, O king, we will not serve your gods. We will not worship the golden statue that you have set up. We won't do it. Even if it costs us our very life, we won't do it. That, my friends, that is conviction. That is the answer of faith. That is the answer of a hero. See, a hero says, I can't change. I am focused on what I believe to be the most important thing. I will not change. I will not be detoured. I will not even give consideration to something else, even if it costs me my life right now. If our God chooses, he can deliver us. If he chooses not, let it be known, he is God. So even if they went down in flames, they were going to proclaim that God is God above all. And there is no discussion. What amazing conviction. And again, that gives us a sense. This is so many years after their first test that's recorded in the scriptures. And of course, we know what happens at the end of this, right?
Yeah. Well, the king heated up the furnace 7 times hotter than normal. First of all, he was so mad at those comments, those words.
And they get thrown in. As a matter of fact, the soldiers that throw them into the furnace die from the heat.
That's right.
And they get thrown into the...
And those were the best of the king's soldiers.
Yeah, yeah. And they get thrown into the furnace, and God delivers them. And they come out of the furnace, and the individual examining them says, the ropes have been burned off their hands. I don't even smell smoke on them. They have not been touched by the flames. And, of course, Nebuchadnezzar's immediate reaction is, oh, praise be to the God of these men. He had a lot of reactions like that.
Yes.
And he forgot. See, he appreciated God, but he didn't worship God.
Mm-hmm.
Not until the end of his life. Well, that's a different story. But what a great example of conviction. So, Jonathan, let's begin to wrap this program up here. What this tells us is God's heroes are fearless. Doesn't mean they don't make mistakes.
Or they're not fearful or scared.
Right. Being fearless means to move forward in spite of the fear. It doesn't mean that you have a complete absence of fear. It doesn't mean you're numb to fear. It means that your conviction is greater than your fear. That's what it means. Let's take a look at another account here quickly. The build up to the stoning of Stephen.
Acts 6, 12 through 15 and chapter 7, 1 and 2. And they stirred up the people and the elders and the scribes and came upon him and caught him and brought him to the council and set up false witnesses, which said, this man ceaseth not to speak blasphemous words against the holy place and the law. For we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth shall destroy this place and shall change the customs which Moses delivered unto us. And all that sat in the council and looked steadfastly on him saw his face as if it had been a face of an angel. Then said the high priest, are these things so? And he said, men, brethren, and fathers, hearken. The God of glory appeared unto our father Abraham.
So you have all of these blazing accusations that are coming against Stephen, and Stephen is given a chance to speak.
And boy, does he speak.
He certainly does. And that's in Acts chapter 7. And he tells them the plan of God up to that very moment and beyond. And he is so engrossed in the plan, he's not worried about what it's going to mean to him.
That's right.
All he's worried about is, they've given me the opportunity. I've got to tell them the truth.
And he used zeal and faith, and he just poured his heart before them.
He knelt in prayer, and that's humility. He was willing to stand in faith, and as a result of that, he could speak the truth. And what happens at the end of all of that is, well, why don't you read it quickly, Jonathan, Acts 7:54 to 60.
When they heard these things, they became enraged and ground their teeth at Stephen. But filled with the Holy Spirit, he gazed into heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God. Look, he said, I see the heavens opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God. But they covered their ears and with a loud shout all rushed together against him. Then they dragged him out of the city and began to stone him. And the witnesses laid their cloaks at the feet of a young man named Saul. While they were stoning Stephen, he prayed, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. Then he knelt down and cried out in a loud voice, Lord, do not hold this sin against them. When he had said this, he died.
So you have the ending of the account of Stephen, and this one ends in death. Now see, the last one ended in deliverance.
That's right.
This one ends in death. So Stephen's conviction cost him his life.
And then he asked forgiveness of those that committed this.
For those,
this,
yeah, right.
Death. Yeah.
So there's the conviction was such that the boundaries between life and death became blurred. That's where heroism can go. That's where we need to get a sense of how to put things in perspective and get an understanding of what it is that is so important. So, Jonathan, let's again touch on those five C's of heroism. And again, it's not for being a hero once. It's not performing a heroic act that we're interested in here. What we're interested in, what we want to focus on, is how do you become a hero throughout a lifetime?
The first C is conscience.
You have to have a conscience. And is it just any old conscience?
One that's finely tuned.
It's got to be tuned to something that's bigger and better than you are, something with integrity, something with purpose.
The second C is circumstances, such that require heroic acts.
When you have a finely tuned conscience, you will come across circumstances that are going to require you to use that finely tuned conscience. That's a given in everyone's life.
The third C is cause, one that is noble.
Your cause, when it comes out through the circumstances, and it's something real and something tangible and something big and something important, it begins to drive you.
The fourth C is courage above that of normal people.
Courage is not the absence of fear, but it's action in spite of fear. It's using fear as a catapult to move forward, and that is courage comes because of a cause.
The fifth C is conviction that burns deeply within and dictates one's actions.
The conviction that we're talking about this morning is wrapping up those first four things and being able to do them over and over and over. When you can repeat the process again and again throughout the period of your lifetime, that's where the hero comes out. Folks, can you be a hero? The best way to do it is to start right now, focus your conscience, look at your circumstances, make sure you have a cause, have great courage, and that all produces conviction. For Jonathan and Rick, this is Christian Questions. We've enjoyed being with you this morning, and we look forward to another subject yet again next week. But until then, what makes a hero? What makes someone special like that? Well, there's an awful lot for you to look at, study, and most importantly, to think about.